You've got to say this about Britain. Every political party is determined to rescue the place. Rescue as in a drowning child or an old family firm going bust. It's plucky, but frankly a little confusing because very little seems to happen, which is why we need Ian Dunt to make sense of it all. Ian Dunt, columnist with iNews, co-host of the Origin Story podcast, joins us once again to talk the UK. But today, we take the long view of the UK 2025. Ian, welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much indeed.
Ian, a thumbnail sketch of the year. We'll get to the details, but a thumbnail sketch of Britain 2025.
A sort of combination of paradox and despair, really. Because, you know, this is the first full year of a Labour government since 2010. First time since 2016, the Brexit referendum, when there's been adult, serious, grown-up politicians in charge who don't seem to be undergoing some kind of hysterical, semi-religious, emotional collapse. And yet, it's felt like there's almost been no period of my life where the right, and it's not even really the right, it's the far right, have been making greater gains, like having more control over the political conversation, having more control over the cultural conversation, having more control over the moral standards, over the policy agenda, over the mechanisms of government and the communication strategy of government. So it's extraordinary. It's like the first time we suddenly get some semblance of rationality in government. And at almost exactly the same point, the whole of the moral and political context of our national conversation seems to collapse from underneath.
Why?
It's multi-pronged. The first part is Elon Musk's takeover of X. And it turns out that that was a more important factor than Donald Trump winning the election, than anything going on with Nigel Farage. What took place at that moment, really at the turn of the year, it was almost exactly at the beginning of the year, was myself and pretty much everyone else on the sort of the center, the bits of the center right, the center left, and further to the left, just left X. Twitter, as we used to call it, as one, saying, I cannot
departed.
Be in a situation where I'm going to give money. Departed. Yeah, and went over to Blue Sky. Said, I can't be in a situation. I mean, I have very few moral standards in my life. But one of the few moral standards I do have is that I don't give money to Nazis. And at the point that someone is demonstrably a Nazi, doing Nazi salutes, meeting with fascists, going on fascist rallies, Tommy Robinson, the far-right rally in London, Elon Musk appeared on video screen there. And I sort of thought, I sort of presume that everyone, no matter how much you disagree with them, that you interact with in normal life, had the same moral value, that they wouldn't give money to Nazis either. Evidently, that is not the case. However, the mainstream political conversation did not. Actors would still post there. Sports people would still post there. So journalists, whether they're at the BBC or Sky News or any of the newspapers, still felt they had to be there, apart from The Guardian, to be fair, which did leave. Politicians from any party, Liberal Democrats, Labour, as well as the Conservatives, they stayed there. So the mainstream political conversation stayed on a website that has been designed. I mean, it's not like a coincidence. It's been designed to spread far-right messages. And I have just watched the mainstream, including people who think they're far too clever for this, radicalise over the course of the year as they're stuck in that information ecosystem.
And there's no ecosystem to compete with it because everybody is just out there. Newspapers don't work anymore to compete with it, or are newspapers playing along as well in Britain?
I mean, in Britain, I'd say the newspapers are actively part of spreading that far-right messaging. So, I mean, we have always had a very right-wing print ecosystem, as you yourself do as well, for the basic reason that, you know, you have a proprietor, proprietors tend to be right-wing, you need a proprietor really that's going to lose a bit of money in order to sell newspapers. They've always, for hundreds of years, had a slant towards the right. So here, I mean, which liberal newspapers are there left? The Guardian, the Financial Times, and the Daily Mirror, a working-class newspaper. Apart from that, they're pretty much all on the right. You know, and that's the sort of messaging, and my own paper, the iNews, which has no political agenda at all. Apart from that, you know, the Daily Mail, the Daily Telegraph, the Daily Express, the Sun, they're all just pumping out right-wing messaging, and they love the new, much more extreme far-right messaging that we're getting, led internationally by the Donald Trump administration, spread through his UK kind of unit of Nigel Farage, who then, because he is ahead in the polls, and just marginally ahead in the polls, is treated as if he was the tribune of the people, as if he was the great authentic voice of you know, the working classes and the middle classes and everyone else. And so suddenly what you see then is the newspapers social media, TV news, and the parliamentary debate all starting to just discuss ideas which 12 months ago they would have been shocked to they would have basically thought someone was persona non grata for voicing them. Mass deportations, the deportation of Muslims, British-born Muslims from Britain. This stuff is said by mainstream commentators, and they are allowed to keep their jobs in a way that they simply wouldn't have been in even 2024, let alone sort of 2016. It has been the velocity of the radicalization of the mainstream conversation in Britain has been one of the most shocking things that I've seen in my adult life. And if you'd asked me 2 years ago whether it was possible, I would have told you that it wasn't.
Ian, the messages can be pumped out, but why are the messages being so enthusiastically received?
Oh, you see, this is fascinating. They're not. Let me frame it this way historically. In the 60s, there was a speech by a man called Enoch Powell. It's called the Rivers of Blood speech.
We know Enoch Powell. He was professor of Greek at Sydney University, yes.
Famously also in that second job, yes. And he did one of the most grotesque anti-immigration speeches that this country had ever heard. I mean, full of violent imagery and racism. It was horrific. And at that point, the elite, and he was a Conservative Party MP, the elites within the Conservative Party, namely Edward Heath, the leader of the Conservative Party, got rid of him.
Because they were disgusted.
Because they were disgusted and they thought, well, you can't speak this way. This is, you know, these were not sort of like pro-immigration. You know, Edward Heath was passing anti-immigration legislation, but it was not racialized legislation. You know, it was about, you know, immigration control. The same you'd see like the editor of the Times, William Rees-Mogg, father of a current politician, Jacob Rees-Mogg, would write that it was an evil speech in a Times editorial. The elite level opposed the speech. In the public, there was much more support. So what you'd find was one of the very early cultural splits in Labour support. Lots of trade union members, dockers, lots of working class support for what Enoch Powell had said. Lots of protests in favour of him. It was actually the other way around. Now, we have seemingly flipped completely. So at the elite level, extremely racist ideas are being voiced. So one of the ideas, for instance, which has started floating around the right-wing podcast sphere and online and has then touched the mainstream conversation is, and I'm sort of ashamed to even say it out loud, is Rishi Sunak really English? Rishi Sunak being the former Conservative Prime Minister, Hindu, you know, born here of Indian heritage. In other words, not white. No one spoke about his race much when he was Prime Minister. Now there's a conversation, can you really be English if you're not white? And we get the obscene spectacle of Suella Braverman, also Asian, former Home Secretary for the Conservative Party, write pieces denying that she herself is English. That's how deeply she's drunk from this far-right well. So at the elite level, that's where the conversation is happening in the Conservative Party. At the public level, when you look at polling, hardly anyone in this country believes that you have to be white to be English. There's about 5% of people think that there's any kind of racial dimension towards Englishness. I think, of course, Englishness is a nationality. You know, you could be of any color, any race, any heritage, and still be English. So funnily enough, in terms of the public, there isn't a huge audience for this stuff. In terms of elite opinion, the radicalization has been extremely notable.
But the radicalization involves, does it not, this backing for Nigel Farage, a rather ordinary politician, gift of the gab, there's no doubt about that, with a simple message, which is anti-immigration. But that does have a constituency, Ian.
Oh, yeah, 100%. So I'd say, you know, whenever you look at polling on immigration, and I mean this over the last, really over the entirety of my lifetime, about a quarter of the country, about 25% of the country, is implacably opposed to immigration. They want huge reductions. They want people to leave. They are very, very anti-immigration. And roughly a quarter of the country, no one ever talks about them, of course, roughly a quarter of the country are very pro-immigration. They want more people coming. They want very open controls, you know, freedom of movement, et cetera. And 50% in the middle are there to be convinced one way or another. And because of the way the information ecosystem works, you know, it's always been pretty anti-immigration in newspapers. They're easier to convince, you know, typically towards the hard end than the easy. But they are there to be convinced. They're pragmatic. They're practical. They're open to ideas. Farage's support, Reform Party support, is at around 30%. I mean, it's just a little bit higher than the 25% you would expect for a party voicing the most anti-immigration position. It's combined with a bunch of people who are basically fed up of the status quo, of things as they are, and they want to kick the system and get change, which is the story that you're seeing across the West, really. Although I know Australia is a more complicated example. There's been a bit more resilience against populism there, arguably. So in that context, him getting 30% is really not that extraordinary a thing. We're in five-party, you know, democracy. He's basically about sort of 6-7 points above Labour, you know, a few more points above the Greens. The Greens are competing with Labour on the low 20s, you know, the Conservatives a little bit lower down, the Liberal Democrats a little bit lower down, maybe 18. Yes, it is troubling. And yes, it is possible that because of the way first-past-the-post electoral dynamics work, he might end up forming the next government on just 30% of the vote. But it is not as if there's been this huge sweeping wave through the country of support for right-wing populism. In fact, the country is as fractured politically as we have pretty much ever seen it in terms of political party support.
Another element of this, of course, is the record in his first, you know, year in office of Starmer. And this seems from a distance to be one of those times when the character of a leader becomes a decisive political consideration.
I think you're spot. I think it's extremely telling that you've spotted that from afar, because it's the sort of thing that you don't always see when you're close up to it day to day. But from a bit further away, it becomes quite obvious that maybe that is the flaw. And I have to sort of grudgingly, I think, accept it. Because I look at it this way. I first came across Keir Starmer when he entered Parliament. He was made Shadow Brexit Secretary. And I was covering Brexit, you know, in a lot of detail at that point. Almost no one in Parliament was talking about the actual technical nuts and bolts detail of the thing. It was all these broad brushstroke, primary colour gibberish. And he came in and understood that it was a contorted and torturous legal complex problem. And basically just broke it down forensically and started causing damage to the government by speaking like an adult and dealing with the empirical world as we might find it. And I just thought, my God, what a rare thing in British politics. Wouldn't it be nice if this man had more influence? So I was very pleased when he became leader. I was very, very pleased when I thought he was going to be prime minister. And I obviously turned out to be really quite catastrophically wrong about that. It's not a political error. It's a practical error about his competence in the job, about his suitability for that role. And I think the thing that I didn't spot was that he really is quite absent politically as a human being. Arguably, even morally, I thought there was morally more to him. But it turns out he pretty much will say anything if he thinks he has to. Now, that has a series of issues with it. One of them is, you know, practical issues, which is essentially that it's very hard for the government to have a communication strategy if the person in charge of the government basically has no opinions and outsources his opinions to the people around him. And that works in terms of the country knowing what you're doing. At the moment, he's saying people need to pay more tax. It's very hard to get people to willingly pay more tax if you won't tell them what it is that they're paying tax for, if you won't give them a narrative that works. But it also matters internally to a government because, you know, you've got disparate departments, Department of Education, the Home Office, the Ministry of Justice. There needs to be an internal communication about where the priorities are for funding, for delivery, for policy mechanisms. And without that, without a really solid character in the middle who can clearly communicate internally in government what they're trying to do, you get this morass, this sort of collapse of the administrative function of the executive. And that's one of the things we've seen. It's not just that he can't communicate, it's that actually the government internally has no sense of direction, has no sense of momentum, has no sense of purpose. And people get that sense of stasis, that sense of sort of anemic, swampy suffocation that comes from an administration like that. And it's one of the really significant reasons that they've been failing so badly with the public and also objectively in terms of their change in the world.
Is there something else that we rarely acknowledge, which is that the public likes a politician who fights? That there is a real kind of enjoyment in a political brawl led by a man or a woman who likes to fight. And I don't get any sense of that from Starmer.
Well, oddly, he does do it. I think you're right in that the narrative comes through your selection of your enemies. So you define yourself in opposition to whoever it is that you're talking about. And Starmer does, I mean, you know, New Labour for a long time in the late 90s and early noughties did well by stitching together an electoral coalition. And that's what liberal democracy should look like. You know, trying to say we're not going to pit the public against each other. We're stitching together through pragmatic, day-to-day pedestrian policies, a coalition of people who have mutual interests. And that has real health in terms of the civic health of the nation. Starmer's disposition is exactly that. And yet he's now told the only way we're going to get these reform voters back, they haven't really lost any voters to reform, but his chief of staff is deeply, a man called Morgan McSweeney, is deeply convinced of the case for right-wing populism and that Labour has to be left economically and right on cultural issues. So you've just got to pick a fight with immigrants. And really, no, it's more than that. The people he's encouraging to fight are liberals. So if you take the policy last week, again, I am so embarrassed to be saying any of this stuff, but it, you know, what can you do? One of the policies announced last week was that the Home Office would confiscate the jewellery of asylum seekers when they arrive in the UK, apart from their wedding rings, and use it to fund the asylum process.
What?
Yeah, I know, I know.
And I mean, I know that they were going to search the mouths of children to find any SIM cards hidden under their tongues. But yeah. Taking the jewellery of people.
I know, I know. And the thing is, look, they tried this. They've nicked this from Denmark, where the Social Democratic Party did it and actually came a cropper on it. And they almost certainly won't end up doing it for all sorts of legal and practical reasons. But that's not why they say it. They say it because they know that it's got this kind of Nazi cosplay to it, that it's just got this sort of almost partition, the really jagged edges of the human condition, the cold men with cold hearts who do the cold thing when it's required, that viciousness to it. They know that in terms of the imagery. They know that it deeply upsets any liberal-minded or moderate-minded person to hear ideas like this. And they wish for that to be the conversation. They want to kick the hell out of liberals. That's what they're attempting to do publicly. So in a way, oddly and half-heartedly, because of course they pull back on this, and no one believes that Keir Starmer, a human rights lawyer from North London, actually wants to do any of this stuff. So it doesn't do them any good electorally with the demographic they're trying to appeal to, who will vote for reform anyway. But nevertheless, they are trying to do these sorties into just beating the hell out of liberals, which manages to lose them the support of people who will actually vote for them without gaining the support of any of the people who never will.
I can't tell you how familiar this is to people in Australia. This is ABC Radio National, Late Night Live, David Marr talking to Ian Dunt about the state of things in the UK. Ian, the budget looks to be raising quite a lot of money. Is it going to solve the fundamental financial problems the government faces? Will it give the government the money it needs to spend?
No. The honest answer to that is that the last budget did the thing that Labour needed, which is that it changed the fiscal rules. The fiscal rules are basically what the Chancellor says to the market in order to assure them of her steeliness. It changed them to allow investment, to allow borrowing to invest. And that was the crucial economic policy of Labour, as to distinguish it from the Tories. And by the way, a very, very, very sensible thing to do and the right thing to do and a big improvement on what we had before. This budget doesn't have any new ideas. It essentially just redistributed money from the better off towards welfare claimants, which, you know, I support, which I think is a good idea. However, the problem in Britain is that there's no growth. Arguably, the problem across the Western world, outside of the US, and even in the US, once you exclude tech companies, there's no growth. This is the main issue and one of the main reasons that we're seeing the rise of populism. And there is no strategy for growth in the budget that we just had. It's just not there. It is a bunch of sticking plaster solutions, another bunch of just sort of no plan, throw your hands in the air, moments of astonishment at the damage that previous administrations have done without any of the courage in order to fix it. And then a series of kind of tinkering tax rises that they're hoping no one really notices. But ultimately, no, there's no real plan for how to get Britain out of the hole. The government's plan has been open up investment in the first budget, close your eyes, cross your fingers, and pray that growth comes back before 2029, before you next go to the public. That really is the entirety of its strategy.
Any possibility of addressing Brexit?
Yeah, there is, increasingly so. It's really changed. I mean, in the last 3 to 4 months, the government has now just started saying Brexit, you know, has done us tremendous damage. It is now reeled out in the list of things that by the Prime Minister, by the ministers, by the Chancellor, in the list of things that the previous government did wrong. Say we're in trouble as a country because of COVID, because of Brexit, because of financial crash, because of austerity, which, by the way, is the correct menu. That's the correct list of things that have really made Britain's pain much worse than comparator or peer countries. So, no, they do talk about it. what they haven't figured, because they aren't, these people are not political geniuses by any stretch of the imagination, is they haven't figured that if you say Brexit is bad, the next question that follows is naturally going to be, why don't you undo it then?
Do something about it.
Exactly. It's not a hard question to predict, but it's one that seems to have surprised them. So now that's where the conversation is. Oh, well, you know, we're already doing this thing where we're coming up with a closer relationship with Europe. They are. But, you know, it's piddling compared to what's required. They're basically coming up with an agricultural deal with Europe, free trade of agricultural goods. And that's fine. But really what you need to improve things in this country, you need more than this. But one of the things you predominantly want is an industrial deal. Britain is not great on manufacturing, predominantly a services economy. And yet in the towns, in large towns, particularly in the Midlands and the North, they're still reliant on manufacturing exports. And that's been hammered by Brexit. These, incidentally, are all the places that voted for Brexit in the first place. You know, so you really need a deal there in order to repair the damage. But doing a deal there would almost certainly require a return to free movement, which brings us back to the immigration debate, which brings us back to how we started this conversation, which is that Labour's utter terror in the face of a far-right narrative agenda over the country.
Look, in this big picture exercise, we must look at another leader. How's the King going? It's been 3 years now, a little over 3 years. How's the King faring?
It's so interesting how little conversation there is about that in the UK. There's conversation, obviously, around, you know, the Epstein sort of story that we've discussed previously.
And poor Andrew Mountbatten Windsor.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And you know, what is the effect on the royal family of this story lapping up on their shores and slowness of dealing with it? But for the King himself, how is he doing? There's almost no conversation. And that in itself is quite telling, I think, because in the years, you know, the last 20 years of the Queen's life, people would instinctively say, and they would say it, this is almost considered a truism, oh, they're in real trouble once the Queen goes, you know, because everyone likes the Queen, but they're not so keen on the royal, you know, on royalty as a concept. So once she goes, the whole institution's in trouble. And it's sort of like, well, not really. And there was also this view, of course, that nobody liked him because of all the, you know, Princess Diana stuff from the 90s. Yeah. And yet the truth is there's been sort of nothing. I mean, he sort of fits in pretty well. He's obviously more outspoken politically, but that doesn't really do him too much harm because the issues that he cares about are left-wing coded, climate change predominantly. Mm. And the right tend not to attack the monarchy. Oh, and the other thing is he really likes Islam. He's very, very pro-Islam and likes meeting religious leaders, wants to be sort of, you know, leader of the faiths rather than leader of the Church of England. So he's in this sweet spot where the right don't criticize the politics because they don't like to criticize the royal family. The left don't criticize the politics because most of the things he's saying they agree with. And so he's had this freedom to actually kind of go beyond the remit of what would be considered normal for a monarch without anyone really criticizing him too harshly.
No prospect of a revolution. In Australia, it was said, the minute the Queen dies, we'll become a republic. There is not a tremor of republican enthusiasm in this country. And maybe that's Britain's mission, Ian, to just keep going.
Oh, no. I mean, that's a very despairing prescription, I think, for anyone. I think that Britain has, like, a lot to offer the world. There's this specific role when it's at its best of one foot in Europe, one foot in the Anglosphere, that is often sort of treated as this idea of like, oh, the former, it's got nothing to do with empire and it's got nothing to do with English speaking. It's the political heritage, the heritage of the philosophy, especially through liberalism, from, you know, common law to Napoleonic, to that sense of why is Britain a country that speaks in terms of personal freedom in a way that is actually quite rare, you know, in a country like France, let's say, or in the Mediterranean. And yet would never have a situation that you would see, for instance, with the Americans, you know, when it comes to healthcare, you know, that has the NHS, that has that sense of, you know, your social situation. There is something very specific that Britain can offer the world, and especially that island history, paradoxically, even though it's got this border by virtue of the water, it has for hundreds of years been open to people, been open to trade, been open to ideas. I'm talking about the good stuff of Britain. I can tell you all the terrible, you know, monstrous things it's done over the last hundreds of years as well. But there are things that Britain has to offer the world if it has the humility and the realism about its place in it and speaks up to its better nature. And yet it's just in this state of pathological insecurity and gradual moral degradation. It's impoverishing us. You know, every time the government passes anti-immigration legislation, we reduce immigration. In the small print of last week's budget, it will say, if we keep on reducing immigration like this, we're going to get poorer. It is hurting GDP. It is damaging higher education. It is hurting social care. It is hurting financial services. We are literally actively, consciously making ourselves poorer because of this poisonous political rhetoric. And yet, for the time being, that better element of Britain's character and its better potential to increase the well-being of its people seems to be completely gone. And we're lost in this lunatic asylum of utter far-right hogwash. And all I can do is just sort of pray that 2026 is at least marginally better than the year that we've just had.
Ian, thank you for looking back on 2020. Thank you for being with us all through this year. We've had wonderful conversations. The listeners of Late Night Live love you, mate. And I look forward very much to joining you again in 2026. Thanks a lot.
Thank you very much.
Have good holidays. See you then.
You too.